me from Fate of Life as Zebedee Blimmin' Zanzibar. Where are we with girls' names? Alice, Amelia, Annabelle, April, Ariadne. Tom raised his eyebrows. And she's off again, Ariadne. Hard enough she's going to live in a lighthouse, let's not lump her with a name that people will laugh at. Only 200 more pages to go, said Isabel with a grin. We'd better hop to it then. That evening, as he looked out from the gallery, Tom returned to his question. Where had this baby's soul been? Where would it go? Where were the souls of the men he'd joked and saluted and trudged through the mud with him? Here he was, safe and healthy with a beautiful wife, and some soul had decided to join them. Out of thin air in the furthest corner of the earth, a baby was coming. He'd been on death's books for so long it seemed impossible that life was making an entry in his favour. He went back into the lantern room and looked at the photograph of Isabel that hung on the wall. The mystery of it all. The mystery. Tom's other gift from the last boat was the Australian Mother's Manual of Efficient Child-Rearing by Dr. Samuel B. Griffiths. Isabel took to reading it at any available moment. She fired information at Tom. Did you know that a baby's kneecaps aren't made of bone? Or, how old do you think babies are when they can take food from a teaspoon? Search me, Ease. Go on, guess. Honestly, how would I know? Oh, you're no fun, she complained and dived into a book for another fact. Within weeks, the pages were frilly edged and blotted with grass stains from the day spent on the headland. You're having a baby, not sitting for an exam. I just want to do things right. It's not like I can pop next door and ask Mum, is it? Oh, Isabella, Tom laughed. What? What's funny? Nothing. Nothing at all. I wouldn't change a thing about you. She smiled and kissed him. You're going to be a wonderful dad, I know. A question came to her eyes. What prompted Tom? Oh, nothing. No, really, what? Your dad. Why do you never talk about him? Oh, no love lost there. But what was he like? Tom thought about it. How could he possibly sum him up? How could he ever explain the look in his eyes, the invisible gap that always surrounded him, so that he never quite made contact? He was right. Always right. Didn't matter what it was about. He knew the rules, stuck to them, come hell or high water. Tom thought back to the straight, tall figure that overshadowed his childhood, hard and cold as a tomb. Was he strict? Tom gave a bitter laugh. Strict doesn't begin to describe it. He put his hand to his chin as he speculated. Maybe he just wanted to make sure his sons didn't kick over the traces. We'd get the strap for anything. Well, I'd get the strap for anything. Cecil had always been the one to tell on me. Got him off lightly. He laughed again. Tell you what, though, made army discipline easy. You never know what you're going to be grateful for. His face grew serious. I suppose it made it easier being over there, knowing that there'd be no one who'd be heartbroken if they got the telegram. Oh, Tom, don't even say such a thing. He drew her head into his chest and stroked her hair in silence. There are times when the ocean is not the ocean, not blue, not even water, but some violent explosion of energy and danger, ferocity on a scale only gods can summon. It hurls itself at the island, sending spray right over the top of the lighthouse, biting pieces off the cliff. And the sound is a roaring of a beast whose anger knows no limits. Those are the nights the light is needed most. In the worst of these storms, Tom stays for the light all night if need be, keeping warm by the kerosene heater, pouring sweet tea from a thermos flask. He thinks about the poor bastards out on the ships, and he thanks Christ he's safe. He watches for distress flares, keeps the dinghy ready for launch, though what good it would do in seas like that, who knows. That May night, Tom sat with a pencil and notebook in hand, adding up his figures. His annual salary was £327. How much did a pair of children's shoes cost? From what Ralph said, kids got through them at a rate of knots. Then there were clothes and school books. Of course, if he stayed on offshore lights, Isabel would teach the kids at home, but on nights like this, he wondered if it was fair to inflict this life on anyone, let alone children. The thought was nudged out by the words of Jack Throssell, one of the keepers back east. Best life in the world for kids, I swear, he told Tom. All 6 of mine are right as rain, always up to games and mischief, exploring caves, making cubbies. Proper gang of pioneers. And the missus makes sure they do their lessons. Take it from me, raising kids on a light station's as easy as wink. Tom went back to his calculations. How he could save a bit more, make sure there was enough put by for clothes and doctors. Lord knows what else. The idea that he was going to be a father made him nervous and excited and worried. As his mind drifted back to memories of his own father, a storm thundered about the light, deafening Tom to any other sound that night, deafening him to the cries of Isabel, calling for his help. Chapter 9. Shall I get you a cup of tea? Tom asked at a loss. He was a practical man. Give him a sensitive technical instrument and he could maintain it. Something broken and he could mend it, meditatively, efficiently. But confronted by his grieving wife, he felt useless. Isabel did not look up. He tried again. Some Vincent's powders? The first aid taught to lightkeepers included restoring the apparently drowned, treating hypothermia and exposure, disinfecting wounds, even the rudiments of amputation. They did not, however, touch on gynaecology, and the mechanics of miscarriage were a mystery to Tom. It had been 2 days since the dreadful storm, 2 days since the miscarriage had begun. Still the blood came, and still Isabel refused to let Tom signal for help. Having stayed on watch throughout that wild night, he had finally returned to the cottage after putting the light out just before dawn. And his body begged for sleep, but entering the bedroom he'd found Isabel doubled up, the bed soaked in blood. The look in her eyes was as desolate as Tom had ever seen. I'm so, so sorry, she'd said. So, so sorry, Tom. Then another wave of pain gripped her, and she groaned and pressed her hands to her belly, desperate for it to stop. Now, she said, what's the point in a doctor? The baby's gone. Her gaze wandered. How hopeless am I, she muttered. Other women have babies as easy as falling off a log. Isabella, stop. It's my fault, Tom, it must be. It's just not true, Is. He pulled her head into his chest and kissed her hair over and over. There'll be another. One day when we've got 5 kids running around and getting under your feet, this'll all feel like a dream. He pulled her shawl around his shoulders. It's beautiful outside. Come and sit on the veranda, it'll do you good. They sat side by side in wicker armchairs, Isabel covered with a blue-checked blanket, and watched the progress of the sun across the late autumn sky. Isabel recalled how she'd been struck by the emptiness of this place, like a blank canvas when she'd first arrived. How gradually she'd come to see into it as Tom did, tuning to the subtle changes. The clouds as they formed and grouped and wandered the sky, the shape of the waves which would take their cue from the wind and the season and could, if you knew how to read them, tell you the next day's weather. She'd become familiar too with the birds which appeared from time to time, against all odds, carried along randomly as the seeds borne on the wind or the seaweed thrown up on the shore. She looked at the 2 pine trees and suddenly wept at their aloneness. There should be forests, she said suddenly. I miss the trees, Tom. I miss their leaves and their smell and the fact that there's so many of them. Oh, Tom, I miss the animals. I bloody miss kangaroos. I miss it all. I know you do, Izzy, Dale. But don't you? You're the only thing in this world that I want, Izzy, and you're right here. Everything else will sort itself out. Just give it time. A sheer velvet veil covered everything. No matter how dutifully Isabel dusted, her wedding photograph, picture of Hugh and Alfie in the uniforms the week they joined up in 1916, grinning as if they'd just been invited to a party. Not the tallest lads in the AIF, but keen as mustard, and so dashing in their brand new slouch hats. Her sewing box was as neat as it needed to be, rather than pristine like her mother's. Needles and pins pierced the cushioned pale green lining, and the panels of her christening gown lay ununited, stopped in mid-stitch like a broken clock. A small string of pearls Tom had given her as a wedding gift sat in a box he had made for her. Her hairbrush and tortoiseshell combs were the only other things on the dressing table. Isabel wandered into the lounge room, observing the dust, a crack in the plaster near the window frame, the frayed edge of the dark blue rug. The hearth needed sweeping, the lining of the curtains had begun to shred from constant exposure to extremes of weather. Simply to think of fixing any of it took more energy than she could muster. Only weeks ago she'd been so full of expectation and vigour. Now the room felt like a coffin, and her life stopped at its edges. She opened the photograph album her mother had prepared for her as a going-away present, with the pictures of her as a child, the name of the photographer's studio, Gutsch's, stamped on the back of each portrait. There was one of her parents on their wedding day, a photograph of home. She trailed her finger over the table, lingering on the lace doily her grandmother had made for her own trousseau. She moved to the piano and opened it. The walnut was split in places. The gold leaf above the keyboard said, Eva Staff, London. She'd often imagined its journey to Australia and the other lives it could have lived, in an English house or a school, sagging under the burden of imperfect scales, played by small, stumbling fingers, perhaps, or even on a stage. Yet through the most unlikely of circumstances, its lot was to live on this island, its voice stolen by loneliness and the weather. She pressed middle C, so slowly that it made no sound. The warm ivory key was as smooth as her grandmother's fingertips, and the touch brought back afternoons of music lessons, of ringing out A-flat major in contrary motion. One octave, then two, then three. The sound of the cricket ball on the wood as Hugh and Alfie larked about outside, while she, a little lady, acquired accomplishments, and listened as her grandmother explained the importance of keeping her wrist raised. But it's stupid contrary motion, Isabel would wail. Well, you'd know all about contrary motion, my dear, her grandmother remarked. Can't I play cricket, Gran? Just a bit and then I'll come back. Cricket's no game for a girl. Now come on. Chopin etude, she would breeze on, opening a book tattooed with pencil marks and small smudged chocolate fingerprints. Isabel stroked the key again. She felt a sudden longing, not just for music, but for that time when she could have rushed outside, hitched up her skirt and stood as a wicket-keeper for her brothers. She pressed the other keys as if they might bring the day back. But the only sound was the muffled clack of the wood against the base of the keyboard, where the felt had worn away. What's the point, she shrugged to Tom as he came in. Tattered, I reckon. Just like me. And she started to cry. Days later, the two of them stood beside the cliff. Tom hammered the small cross he had made from some driftwood until it was secure in the ground. At his wife's request, he had carved 31st of May 1922, remembered always. He took the shovel and dug a hole for the rosemary bush she had moved from the herb garden. He could feel the nausea rising in as a spark of memory arced between the hammering of the cross and the digging of the hole. His palms sweated, though the task required little physical effort. Isabel watched from high on the cliff as Windward Spirit docked on its next run. Ralph and Bluey would make their way up soon enough. No need to go and greet them. They slung the gangplank down, and to his surprise a third man disembarked with them. No maintenance crews were due. Tom came up the path while the other three lingered at the jetty. The stranger who carried a black bag seemed to have some difficulty righting himself after the journey. Isabel's face was tight with anger as Tom approached. How dare you? Tom reeled. How dare I? I told you not to and you went ahead anyway. Well, you can just send him back. Don't bother letting him up here. He's not wanted. Isabel always looked like a child when she was angry. Tom wanted to laugh and his grin infuriated her even more. She put her hands on her hips. I told you I didn't need a doctor, but you went behind my back. I'm not having him prodding and poking about to tell me nothing I don't already know. You should be ashamed of yourself. Well, you can look after them, the whole lot of them. Izzy, Tom called. Izzy, wait! Don't do your nana, love, he's not... But she was already too far off to hear the rest of his words. Well, asked Ralph as he reached on, how'd she take it? Pleased as punch, I bet. Not exactly. Tom stuffed his fists in his pockets. But, Ralph looked at him in amazement. I thought she'd be real chuffed. It took all Frieda's charms to persuade him to come, and my wife doesn't use her charms freely. She, Tom considered whether to explain. She got the wrong end of the stick about it. Sorry, she chucked a wobbly. Once she does that, all you can do is batten down the hatches and wait for it to pass. Means I'll be making sandwiches for lunch, I'm afraid. Bluey and the man approached, and after the introductions, the four of them went inside. Isabel sat in the grass near the cove she had christened Treacherous and seethed. She hated this, the fact that your dirty washing had to be everybody else's business. She hated the fact that Ralph and Bluey had to know. They'd probably spent the whole trip out discussing her most private shame and Lord knows what else. That Tom could ship the doctor out against her explicit wishes felt like a betrayal. She sat watching the water, how the breeze fluffed up the waves which had been so smooth and curled earlier in the day. Hours passed. She grew hungry. She grew sleepy. But she refused to go near the cottage while the doctor was there. She concentrated instead on her surroundings, noticing the texture of each leaf, the precise green of it, listening to all the different pitches of wind and water and birds. She heard a foreign sound, an insistent note, short, repeated. Coming from the light, from the cottage? It was not the usual clang of metal from the workshop. She heard it again, this time at a different pitch. The wind on Janus had a way of raking sounds into separate frequencies, distorting them as they crossed the island. Two gulls came to land nearby and squabble over a fish, and the noise, faint at best, was lost. She went back to her mulling until she was arrested by an unmistakable sound that carried on in the shifting air. It was a scale. Imperfect, but the pitch getting better each time. She'd never heard of Ralph or Bluey mention the piano, and Tom couldn't play for Toffee. Must be the wretched doctor determined to put his fingers where they're not wanted. She'd never been able to get a tune out of the piano, and now it seemed to be singing. Isabel's fury drove her up the path, ready to banish the intruder from the instrument, from her body, from her home. She passed the outbuildings where Tom, Ralph, and Bluey were stacking sacks of flour. "Afternoon, Isabel," Ralph attempted, but she marched past him into the house. She barged into the lounge room. "If you don't mind, that's a very delicate instrument." She began, but got no further, flummoxed by the sight of the piano, completely stripped down. A box of tools open and the stranger turning the nut above one of the base copper wires with a tiny spanner as he hit its corresponding key. "Mummified seagull, that's your problem," he said without looking around. "Well, one of them. That and a good 20 years' worth of sand and salt and God knows what. Once I replace some of the felts, it'll start to sound better." He continued to tap the key and turn the spanner as he spoke. "I've seen all sorts in my time. Dead rats, sandwiches, a stuffed cat. I could write a book about the things that ended up inside a piano that I couldn't tell you how they got there. I'm betting the seagull didn't fly in by itself." Isabel was so taken aback that she couldn't speak. Her mouth was still open when she felt a hand on her shoulder and turned to find Tom. She flushed deep red. "So much for surprises, eh?" he said and kissed her cheek. Well, it was..." Isabel's voice trailed off. He slipped a hand around her waist and the two of them stood for a moment, forehead touching forehead, before breaking into laughter. She sat for the next 2 hours watching the tuner as he coaxed a brighter sound, getting the notes to ring out once again, louder than ever before, and he finished with the burst of the Hallelujah chorus. "I've done my best, Mrs. Sherborne," he said as he packed away his tools. "Really needs to come into the workshop, but the trip out and back would do as much harm as good. She's not perfect by a long chalk, but she'll do." He pulled the piano stool out. "Care to give it a bell?" Isabel sat at the keyboard and played the A-flat major scale in contrary motion. "Well, that's a sight better than before," she said. She broke into the beginnings of a Handel aria and was wandering off into memory when someone cleared his throat. It was Ralph standing behind Bluey in the doorway. "Don't stop," Bluey said as she turned to greet them. "I was so rude, I'm sorry," she said, about to get up. "Not a bit of it," said Ralph. "Here, from Hilda," he said, producing behind his back something tied with a red ribbon. "Oh, shall I open it now?" "You'd better. If I don't give her a blow-by-blow report, I'll never hear the end of it." Isabel opened the wrapping and found Bach's Goldberg Variations. "Tom reckons you can play this sort of cape with your eyes shut." "I haven't played them for years, but I would just love them, thank you." She hugged Ralph and kissed his cheek. "And you too, Bluey," she said with a kiss that accidentally caught his lips as he turned. He blushed violently and looked at the ground. "Oh, I never had much to do with it, I don't reckon," he said. But Tom protested. "Don't believe a word of it. He drove all the way to Albany to fetch him. Took him the whole day yesterday." "In that case, you get an extra kiss," she said, and planted another on his cheek. "And you too," she said, kissing the piano tuner for good measure. That night as he checked the mantel, Tom was serenaded by Bark, the orderly notes climbing the stairs of the lighthouse and ringing around the lantern room, flittering between prisms. Just like the mercury that made the light go round, Isabel was mysterious. Able to cure into poison. Able to bear the whole weight of the light, but capable of fracturing into a thousand uncatchable particles. Running off in all directions, escaping from itself. He went out onto the gallery. As the lights of the windward spirit disappeared over the horizon, he said a silent prayer for Isabel and for their life together. Then he turned to the logbook and wrote in the remarks column for Wednesday, 13th of September, 1922. Visit per storeboat, Archie Pollock, piano tuner. Prior approval granted. Part 2. Chapter 10, 27th of April, 1926. Isabel's lips were pale and her eyes downcast. She still placed her hand fondly on her stomach sometimes, before its flatness reminded her it was empty. And still her blouses bore occasional patches from the last of the breast milk that had come in so abundantly in the first days. A feast for an absent guest. Then she would cry again as though the news were fresh. She stood with sheets in her hand. Chores didn't stop, just as the light didn't stop. Having made the bed and folded her nightgown under the pillow, she headed up to the cliff to sit by the graves a while. She tended the new one with great care, wondering whether the fledgling rosemary would take. She pulled a few weeds from around the two older crosses, now finally crystallized with years of salt, the rosemary growing doggedly despite the gales. When a baby's cry came to her on the wind, she looked instinctively to the new grave. Before logic could interfere, there was a moment when her mind told her it had all been a mistake. This last child had not been stillborn early, but was living and breathing. The illusion dissolved, but the cry did not. And then Tom's call from the gallery. On the beach, a boat! Told her this was not a dream, and she moved as quickly as she could to join him on the way to the dinghy. The man in it was dead, but Tom fished the screaming bundle out of the bow. Bloody hell, he exclaimed. Bloody hell, is he? It's the baby, oh my lord above. Oh, Tom, Tom, here, give it to me. Back in the cottage, Isabel's belly quickened at the very sight of the baby. Her arms knew instinctively how to hold the child and calm her and soothe her. As she scooped warm water over the infant, she registered the freshness of her skin, taut and soft and without a wrinkle. She kissed each of the tiny fingertips in turn, gently nibbling down the nails a fraction so that the child would not scratch herself. She cupped the baby's head in the palm of her hand, and with the silk handkerchief she kept for best, dabbed away a fine crust of mucus from under her nostrils, and wiped the dry salt of tears from around her eyes. The moment seemed to merge into one with another bathing, another face, a single act that had been merely interrupted. Looking into those eyes was like looking at the face of God. No mask or pretense. The baby's defenselessness was overwhelming. That this intricate creature, this exquisite crafting of blood and bones and skin, could have found its way to her, was humbling. That she could have arrived now barely 2 weeks after, it was impossible to see it as mere chance. Frail as a falling snowflake, the baby could so easily have melted into oblivion had the currents not borne her, arrowed true and safe to shipwreck beach. In a place before words in some other language of creature to creature, with the softening of her muscles, the relaxing of her neck, the baby signalled her trust. Having come so close to the hands of death, life now fused with life like water meets water. Isabel was awash with emotions, awe at the grip of the miniature hands when they latched onto a single finger of her own, amusement at the sweet little bottom which was yet to become fully distinct from the legs, reverence for the breath which drew in the air around and transformed it into blood, into soul. And below all of these hummed the dark, empty ache. "Look, you've made me cry, my poppet," said Isabel. "However did you manage that, you tiny little, perfect little thing?" She lifted the baby from the bath like a sacred offering, laid her on a soft white towel and began to dab her dry, like blotting ink so as not to smudge it, and so if she were not careful she could erase it altogether. Baby lay patiently while she was dusted with talcum, a new nappy pinned. Isabel did not hesitate as she went to the chest of drawers in the nursery and chose from the various unworn garments. She took out a yellow dress with ducklings on the bodice and fitted the child carefully into it. Humming a lullaby, skipping bars here and there, she opened the palm of a tiny hand and considered its lines. There from the moment of birth, the path already mapped which had brought her here to this shore. "Oh, my beautiful, beautiful little thing," she said. But the exhausted baby was now fast asleep, taking small, shallow breaths, occasionally giving a shiver. Isabel held her in one arm as she went about putting a sheet into the cot, shaking out the blanket she had crocheted from soft lamb's wool. She could not quite bring herself to put the baby down, not just yet. In a place far beyond awareness, a flood of chemicals which until so recently had been preparing her body for motherhood conspired to engineer her feelings, guide her muscles. Instincts which had been thwarted rushed back to life. She took the baby into the kitchen and rested her on her lap as she searched through the book of babies' names. A light keeper accounts for things. Every article in the light station is listed, stored, maintained, inspected. No item escapes official scrutiny. The deputy director of lights lays claims to everything from the tubes for the burners to the ink for the logs, from the brooms in the cupboard to the boot scraper by the door. Each is documented in the leather-bound register of equipment, even the sheep and goats. Nothing is thrown away, nothing is disposed of without formal approval from Fremantle, or if it is very costly, Melbourne. Lord help the keeper who is down a box of mantles or a gallon of oil and cannot explain it. No matter how remote their lives, like moths in a glass case, the light keeps it pinned down, scrutinized, powerless to escape. You can't trust the lights to just anyone. The logbook tells the tale of the keeper's life from the same steady pen, the exact minute the light was lit, the exact minute it was put out the following morning, the weather, the ships that passed, those that signalled, those that inched by on a squally sea, too intent on dealing with the waves to break into Morse, or still sometimes international code about where they came from or where they were bound. Once in a while a keeper might have a little joke to himself, decorating the start of a new month with a scroll or curlicue. He might craftily record that the Inspector of Lights has confirmed his long service leave on the basis that there's no naysaying what's written there. But that's as far as liberties are taken. The log is the gospel truth. Janus isn't a Lloyd's station. It's not one of the ships to depend on for forecasts, so once Tom closes the pages from the book, it's unlikely that any eyes will ever glance at it again, perhaps ever. But he feels particular peace when he writes. The wind is still measured using the system from the ages of sail. Calm, 0 to 2 sufficient wind for working ships, to hurricane, 12, no sail can stand, even running. He relishes the language. When he thinks back to the chaos, the years of manipulating facts or the impossibility of knowing, let alone describing what the bloody hell was going on while explosions shattered the ground all around him, he enjoys the luxury of stating a simple truth. It was therefore the logbook that first played on Tom's mind that the day the boat arrived. It was second nature to him to report any little thing that might have significance, bound not only by the rules of his employment but by Commonwealth law. His information might only be one tiny piece of a puzzle, a piece he alone could contribute, and it was vital that he do so. A distress flare, a wisp of smoke on the horizon, a bit of metal washed up that might turn out to be wreckage, all were recorded in his steady, efficient hand, the letters sloping gently and evenly forward. He sat at the desk below the lantern room, his fountain pen waiting faithfully to report the day. A man was dead. People should be notified, inquiries made. He drew more ink into the pen even though it was almost full. He checked back over a few details in previous pages and then went to the very first entry he'd ever recorded. That grey Wednesday he'd arrived on Janus 6 years before. The days had followed like the rise and fall of the tide since then, and through all of them, when he was dog-tired from urgent repairs, or on watch all night during a storm, or wondering what the hell he was doing there, even the desperate days of Isabel's miscarriages. There was never one when putting ink to the page made him so uneasy. But she had begged him to wait a day. His thoughts revisited the afternoon just 2 weeks earlier when he'd returned from fishing to be greeted by Isabel's cries. "Tom! Tom, quick!" Running into the cottage, he had found her lying on the kitchen floor, Tom! Something's wrong! She was groaning between words. It's coming! The baby's coming! Are you sure? Of course I'm not sure. I don't know what's going on. I just... Oh, sweet Jesus. Tom, it hurts. Let me help you up, he urged, kneeling down beside her. No, don't move me. She was panting, battling the pain for each breath, moaning the phrases. It hurts too much. Oh, God, make this stop, she cried, as blood seeped through her dress onto the floor. This was different from before. Isabel was nearly 7 months along, and Tom's previous experience was of little help. Tell me what to do, Iz. What do you want me to do? She was fumbling about her clothes, trying to get her blooms off. Tom lifted her hips and pulled them down and over her ankles as she started to moan more loudly, twisting this way and that, her cries ringing out over the island. The labour was as quick as it was early, and Tom watched helpless as a baby. It was unmistakably a baby, his baby, emerged from Isabel's body. It was bloody and small, a mocking scale model of the infant they'd so long been waiting for, drowned in a wash of blood and tissue and mess from a woman so unprepared for its arrival. About a foot long from head to toe, no heavier than a bag of sugar. It made no movement, uttered no sound. He held it in his hands, torn between wonder and horror, not knowing what he was supposed to do or feel. Give her to me, Isabel screamed. Give me my baby, let me hold her. A little boy was all Tom could think of to say as he handed her the warm body to his wife. It was a little boy. The wind had kept up its sudden howl. The late afternoon sun continued to shine in through the window, laying a blanket of bright gold over the woman and her almost baby. The old clock on the kitchen wall still clicked its minutes with fussy punctuality. A life had come and gone, and nature had not paused a second for it. The machine of time and space grinds on, and people are fed through it like grist through the mill. Isabel had managed to sit up a little against the wall, and she sobbed at the sight of the diminutive form which she had dared to imagine as bigger, as stronger, as a child of this world. My baby, she whispered like a magic incantation that might resuscitate him. The face of the creature was solemn, a monk deep in prayer, eyes closed, mouth sealed shut, already back in that world from which he had apparently been reluctant to stray. Still the officious hands of the clock tuttered their way around. Half an hour had passed and Isabel had said nothing. I'll get you a blanket. No, she grabbed his hand. Don't leave us. Tom sat beside her, his arm around her shoulders. She sobbed against his chest. The blood had started to dry at the edges of the pool on the floor. Death, blood, comforting the wounded, all were familiar. But not like this. A woman, baby. No explosions or mud. Everything else was exactly as it should be. The willow pattern plate stood neatly in the dish drainer. Tea towel hung over the oven door. The cake Isabel had made that morning lay upside down in the cooling rack. The tin still covered with damp cloth. After a while, Tom said, well, what should we do with him? Isabel looked at the cold creature in her arms. Light the chip heater. Tom glanced at her. Light it, please. Still confused, but wary of upsetting it, Tom rose to his feet and went to light the water heater. When he returned, she said, fill the laundry tub when the water's warm. If you want a bath, I'll carry you, Iz. Not for me, I have to wash him. Then in the linen cupboard there are the good sheets, the ones I embroidered. Will you bring one? Iz, love, there'll be time for all that. You're what matters most right now. I'll go and signal, get a boat sent out. No, her voice was fierce. No, I don't want anyone else here. I don't want anyone else to know. Not yet. But sweet, you've lost so much blood. You're white as a ghost. You should get a doctor out here to take you back. The tub, Tom, please. When the water was warm, Tom filled the metal tub and lowered it to the floor beside Isabel. He handed her a flannel. She dipped it in the water and gently, gently, with the cloth covering her fingertip, began to stroke the face, smoothing away the watery blood that covered the translucent skin. The baby stayed at his prayers, locked in some secret conversation with God. She lowered the cloth in the water to rinse it. She squeezed it and began again, watching closely, perhaps hoping that the eyes might flicker or the minuscule fingers twitch. "Ease," Tom said softly, touching her hair. "You've got to listen to me now. I'm going to make you some tea with lots of sugar in it. And I need you to drink it for me, all right? And I'm going to get a blanket to put over you. I'm going to clean things up here a bit. You don't have to go anywhere, but you have to let me take care of you now. No arguments. I'm going to give you some morphine tablets for the pain and some iron pills, and you're going to take them from me." His voice was gentle and calm, simply reciting some facts. Transfixed by ritual, Isabel continued to dab away at the body, the umbilical cord still attached to the afterbirth on the floor. She hardly raised her head as Tom draped a blanket over her shoulders. He came back with a bucket and a cloth, and on his hands and knees started to sponge up the blood and mess. Isabel lowered the body into the bath to wash it, taking care not to submerge the face. She dried it with a towel and wrapped it in a fresh one, still with the placenta so that it was bound up like a papoose. "Tom, will you spread the sheet on the table?" He moved the cake tin aside and laid out the embroidered sheet, folded in half. Isabel handed him the bundle. "Lie him down on it," she said, and he rested the little body there. "Now we need to look after you," said Tom. "Still hot water. Come, let's get you clean. Come on, lean on me. Slowly does it now. Slowly, slowly." Thick drops of scarlet splashed his trail as he led her from the kitchen into the bathroom, where this time it was he who dabbed her face with the flannel, rinsing it in the basin and starting again. An hour later, in a clean nightgown, her hair tied back in a plait, Isabel lay in bed. As Tom stroked her face, she eventually succumbed to exhaustion and the morphine tablets. Back in the kitchen, he finished cleaning up and put the soiled linen into the laundry trough to soak. As darkness fell, he sat at the table and lit the lamp. He said a prayer over the little body. The vastness, the tiny body, eternity and the clock that accused the time of passing. It all made even less sense here than it had in Egypt or France. He had seen so many deaths, but there was something about the quietness of this one, as though in the absence of gunfire and shouting he were observing it unobscured for the first time. The men he'd accompanied to the border of life would be mourned by a mother, but on the battlefield the loved ones were far away and beyond imagining. To see a child torn away from his mother at the very moment of birth, torn away from the only woman in the world Tom cared about, was a more dreadful kind of pain. He glanced again at the shadows cast by the baby and beside it the cake covered with a cloth, like a shrouded twin. "Not yet, Tom. I'll tell them when I'm ready," Isabel had insisted the following day as she lay in bed. "But your mum and dad, they'll want to know. They're expecting you home on the next boat. They're expecting their first grandchild." Isabel had looked at him helpless. "Exactly. They're expecting their first grandchild and I've lost him." "They'll be worried for you, Is." "Then why upset them? Please, Tom, it's our business, my business. We don't have to tell the whole world about it. Let them have their dream a little bit longer." "I'll send a letter when the boat comes again in June. That's weeks away. Tom, I just can't." A tear dropped on her nightgown. "At least I'll have a few more happy weeks." So he'd given in to a wish and let the logbook stay silent. But that was different. It was a personal matter. The arrival of the dinghy left no such leeway. Now he began by recording the steamer he'd seen that morning. Manchester Queen bound for Cape Town. Then he noted the calm conditions, the temperature, and put down his pen. Tomorrow. He would tell the whole story of the boat's arrival tomorrow, once he had sent the signal. He paused for a moment to consider whether to leave a space so that he could come back and fill it in, or whether it was best to simply imply that the boat had arrived later than it had. He left a space. He would signal in the morning and say that they'd been too preoccupied with the baby to make contact sooner. The log would tell the truth, but a bit late, just one day. He He caught sight of his reflection in the glass over the notice under Lighthouses Act 1911, which hung on the wall, and for a moment did not recognise the face he saw there. "I'm not exactly an expert in this department," Tom said to Isabel on the afternoon of the baby's arrival. "You never will be if you just stand around like that. I just need you to hold her while I check the bottles warm enough. Come on, she won't bite," she said, smiling. "Not for now, at any rate." The child was barely the length of Tom's forearm, but he took her as though he were handling an octopus. "Just stay still a minute," said Isabel, arranging his arms. "All right. Keep them like that. Now." She made a final adjustment. "She's all yours for the next 2 minutes," and she went through to the kitchen. It was the first time Tom had ever been alone with the baby. He stayed as if standing to attention, terrified of failing inspection. The child started to wriggle, kicking her feet and arms in a manoeuvre which flummoxed him. "Oh, steady on. Be fair on a bloke now," he implored as he tried to get a better grip. "Remember to keep her head supported," Isabel called. Immediately he slipped a hand up to the baby's scalp, registering its smallness in the palm of his hand. She squirmed again, so he rocked her gently. "Come on. Be a sport. Play fair with your Uncle Tom." As she blinked at him and looked right into his eyes, Tom was suddenly aware of an almost physical ache. She was giving him a glimpse of a world he would now surely never know. Isabel returned with the bottle. "Here." She put it into Tom's hand and guided it into the baby's mouth, demonstrating how to tap gently at her lips until she latched on. Tom was absorbed by how the process performed itself. The very fact that the baby required nothing of him stirred a sense of reverence for something far beyond his comprehension. When Tom went back to the light, Isabel busied herself around the kitchen, preparing dinner while the child slept on. As soon as she heard a cry, she hurried to the nursery and lifted her from the cot. The baby was fractious and again nuzzled into Isabel's breast, starting to suck at the thin cotton of her blouse. "Oh, my darling, are you still hungry? Old Doc Griffith's manual says to be careful not to give you too much, but maybe just a drop." She warmed a little more milk and offered the bottle to the baby. But this time the child turned her head away from the teat and cried as she poured instead at the inviting warm nipple that touched her cheek through the cloth. "Come on. Here you are, here's the bottle, sweet thing," Isabel cooed. But the baby became more distressed, kicking her arms and legs and turning into Isabel's chest. Isabel remembered the fresh agony of the arrival of the milk, making her breasts heavy and sore with no baby to suckle. It seemed like a particularly cruel mechanism of nature. Now this infant was seeking desperately for her milk, or perhaps just for comfort, now that immediate starvation had been staved off. She paused for a long moment, her thoughts swirling with the crying and the longing and the loss. "Oh, little sweetheart," she murmured, and slowly unbuttoned her blouse. Seconds later, the child had latched on fast, sucking contentedly, though only a few drops of milk came. They'd been like that for a good while when Tom entered the kitchen. "How's the..." He stopped in mid-sentence, arrested at the sight. Isabel looked up at him, her face a mixture of innocence and guilt. "It's the only way I could get her to settle." "Well... Alarmed, Tom couldn't even frame his questions. "She was desperate. Wouldn't take the bottle. She took it earlier, I saw it. Yes, because she was starving, probably literally." Tom continued to stare, completely out of his depth. "It's the most natural thing in the world, Tom. The best possible thing I could do for her. Don't look so shocked." She reached out a hand to him. "Come here, doll. Give me a smile." He took her hand but remained bewildered, and deep within, his uneasiness grew. That afternoon, Isabel's eyes were alive with a light Tom had not seen for years. "Come and look," she exclaimed. "Isn't she a picture? She fits just beautifully." She gestured to the wickerwork cot in which the child slept peacefully, her tiny chest rising and falling in a miniature echo of the waves around the island. "Snug as a walnut in a shell, isn't she?" said Tom. "I'd say she's not 3 months old yet." "How can you tell?" "I looked it up," Tom raised an eyebrow, "in Dr. Griffith's." I've picked some carrots and some turnips, and I've made a stew with the last of the mutton. I want to have a special tea tonight. Tom frowned, puzzled. We need to welcome Lucy and say a prayer for her poor father. If that's who he was, said Tom. And Lucy? Well, she needs a name. Lucy means light, so it's perfect, isn't it? Isabella. He smiled and stroked her hair, gently serious. Be careful, sweet. I don't want to see you upset. As Tom lit up for the evening, he still couldn't drive away the uneasiness, nor could he tell whether it came from the past, reawakened grief, or from foreboding. As he made his way down the narrow, winding stairs across each of the metal landings, he felt a heaviness in his chest, and a sense of sliding back into darkness he thought he had escaped. That night they sat down to dinner, accompanied by the snuffling of the child, the occasional gurgle, bringing a smile to Isabel's lips. I wonder what will become of her, she pondered aloud. It's sad to think she could end up in an orphanage, like Sarah Porter's little boy. Later they made love for the first time since her stillbirth. Isabel seemed different to Tom, assured, relaxed. She kissed him afterwards and said, Let's plant a rose garden when spring comes. One that'll be here years after we're gone. I'll send the signal this morning, Tom said just after dawn as he returned from extinguishing the light. The pearl-shell glow of day stole into the bedroom and caressed the baby's face. She'd woken in the night and Isabel had brought her into sleep between them. She put her finger to her lips as she nodded towards the sleeping infant and rose from the bed to lead Tom into the kitchen. Sit down, love, and I'll make tea, she whispered and marshalled cups, pot and kettle as quietly as she could. As she put the kettle on the stove, she said, Tom, I've been thinking. What about Izzy? Lucy, it can't just be a coincidence that she turned up so soon after. The sentence did not need completing. We can't just ship her off to an orphanage. She turned to Tom and took his hand in hers. Sweetheart, I think she should stay with us. Oh, fair go now, Dale. She's a lovely baby, but she doesn't belong to us. We can't keep her. Why not? Think about it. I mean, practically speaking, who's to know she's here? When Ralph and Bluey come in a few weeks, they'll know for a start. Yes, but it occurred to me last night they won't know she's not ours. Everyone still thinks I'm expecting. They'll just be surprised she arrived early. Tom watched, his mouth open. But, Izzy, are you in your right mind? Do you realise what you're suggesting? I'm suggesting kindness, that's all. Love for a baby. I'm suggesting, sweetheart, she clasped his hands tighter, that we accept this gift that's been sent to us. How long have we wanted a baby, prayed for a baby? Turning to the window, Tom put his hands on his head and started to laugh, then stretched his arm up in appeal. Oh, for heaven's sake, Isabel. When I tell them about the fellow in the boat, eventually someone will know who he is, and they'll work out that there was a baby. Maybe not straight away, but in the long run. Then I think you shouldn't tell them. Not tell them? His tone was suddenly sober. She stroked his hair. Don't tell them, sweetheart. We've done nothing wrong except give shelter to a helpless baby. We can give the poor man a decent burial and the boat will just set it adrift again. Izzy, you know I'd do anything for you, Dale, but whoever that man is, whatever he's done, he deserves to be dealt with properly. And lawfully, for that matter. What if the mother's not dead and he's got a wife fretting, waiting for them both? What woman would let a baby out of her sight? Face it, Tom, she must have drowned. She clasped his hand again. I know how much your rules mean to you, and I know that this is technically breaking them. But what are those rules for? They're to save lives. That's all I'm saying we should do, sweetheart. Save this life. She's here, she needs us, and we can help her, please. Izzy, I can't. This isn't up to me, don't you understand? Her face darkened. How can you be so hard-hearted? All you care about is your rules and your ships and your bloody light. These were accusations Tom had heard before when wild with grief after her miscarriages. Isabel had let loose her rage against the only person there, the man who continued to do his duty, who comforted her as best he could but kept his own grieving to himself. Once again he sensed her close to a dangerous brink, perhaps closer this time than she'd ever been. Chapter 11. An inquisitive gull watched Tom from its seaweed-cushioned rock. It followed him with an implacable eye as he wrapped the body, now pungent with that smell of the dead, in the canvas. It was hard to tell what the man might have been in life. His face was neither very old nor very young. He was slight, blonde. He had a small scar on his left cheek. Tom wondered who missed him. Who might have cause to love or hate him? The old graves from the shipwreck lay on low ground near the beach. As he set about digging the fresh hole, his muscles took over, executing their familiar task from blind memory, in a ritual he'd never expected to repeat. The first time he'd reported for the daily burial parade, he'd vomited at the sight of the corpses stretched out side by side, waiting for his shovel. After a while, it became just a job. He would hope to get the skinny bloke or the one with the legs blown off because he was a bloody sight easier to move. Bury them, mark the grave, salute and walk away, that's how it was. Hoping for the one with the most bits blown off. Tom went cold at the thought that there had seemed nothing strange about that back then. The shovel gave a gasp at each contact with the sandy soil. Once the ground had been patted back into a neat mound, he stopped to pray for a moment for whoever the poor wretch was, but he found himself whispering, "Forgive me, Lord, for this and all my sins. And forgive Isabel. You know how much goodness there is in her. You know how much she suffered. Forgive us both. Have mercy." He crossed himself and returned to the boat, ready to drag it back into the water. He gave it a heave, and a ray of light pricked his eyes as the sun glinted off something. He peered into the hull of the dinghy. Something shiny was wedged under the rib of the bow, and resisted his first attempt to grasp it. After pulling for a moment, he prized away a cold, hard shape which came to life, jangling. Silver rattle embossed with cherubs and hallmarked. He turned it over and over as if waiting for it to speak to him, to give him some kind of clue. He thrust it in his pocket. Any number of stories might account for the arrival of this strange pair on the island. But only telling himself Izzy's story that the child was an orphan would allow him to sleep at night. Did not bear thinking beyond that, and he needed to avoid any proof to the contrary. He fixed his eyes on the line where the ocean met the sky like a pair of pursed lips. Better not to know. He made sure that the boat had been picked up by the southerly current before wading back into the beach. He was grateful for the salty stink of the green-black seaweed rotting on the rocks, which washed the smell of death from his nostrils. A tiny purple sand crab ventured out from under a ledge, sidled busily over to a dead blowfish, swollen and spiky even in death, and began to pincer little pieces from the belly into its own mouth. Tom shivered and started the steep trek up the path. "Most days there's nowhere to escape the wind round here. It's all right if you're a seagull or an albatross. See how they just sit on the currents of air like they're having a rest?" As he sat on the veranda, Tom pointed to a great silver bird which had made its way from some other island and seemed to hang in a still sky on a thread, despite the turbulent air. The baby ignored Tom's finger and instead gazed into his eyes, mesmerized by the movement of his lips and the deep resonance of his chest. She cooed, a high-pitched half-hiccup. Tom tried to ignore the way his heart kicked in response and continued his discourse. "But in that bay, just that little cove, it's one spot where you're most likely to find a bit of peace and quiet because it faces north and the wind hardly ever comes in due north. That side's the Indian Ocean, nice and calm and warm. Southern Ocean's on the other side, wild and dangerous as anything. You want to keep away from that fella." The child flung an arm above her blanket in response, and Tom let her hand wrap around his index finger. In the weeks since her arrival, he'd become accustomed to her gurgles, to her silent, sleeping presence in her cot, which seemed to waft through the cottage like the smell of baking or flowers. It worried him that he could find himself listening out for her to wake in the morning, or going by reflex to pick her up when she started to cry. "You're falling in love with her, aren't you?" said Isabel, who'd been watching from the doorway. Tom frowned, and she said with a smile, "It's impossible not to. All those little expressions she does. You're going to be a beaut, Dad." He shifted in his chair. "Is it still wrong not reporting it?" "Just look at her. Does she look like we've done anything wrong?" "But that's just it. We don't need to do anything wrong. We could report her now and apply to adopt her. It's not too late, Is. We can still make it right." "Adopt her?" Isabel stiffened. "They'd never send a baby to a lighthouse in the middle of nowhere. No doctor, no school. No church probably worries them the most. And even if they did put her up for adoption, they'd want to give her to some couple in a town somewhere. And besides, it takes forever to go through the rigmarole. They'd want to meet us. You'd never get leave to go and see them, and we're not due back on shore for another year and a half." She put a hand on his shoulder. "I know we'll cope. I know you're going to be a wonderful dad, but they don't." She gazed at the baby and put a finger to her soft cheek. "Bub's bigger than rule books, Tom. If you'd reported the boat, she'd be stuck in some dreadful orphanage by now." She rested her hand on his arm. "Our prayers have been answered. The baby's prayers have been answered. Who'd be ungrateful enough to send her away?" The simple fact was that, sure as a graft will take and fuse on a rose bush, the root stock of Isabel's motherhood, her every drive and instinct left raw and exposed by the recent stillbirth, had grafted seamlessly to the skyon. The baby which needed mothering. Grief and distance bound the wound, perfecting the bond with the speed only nature could engineer. When Tom came down from the lantern room that evening, Isabel was sitting beside the first fire of the autumn, nursing the baby in the rocking chair he had made 4 years ago now. She hadn't noticed him, and he had watched her in silence for a moment. She seemed to handle the child by sheer instinct, incorporating into her every move. He fought back his gnawing doubt. Perhaps Isabel was right. Who was he to part this woman from a baby? In her hands was the Book of Common Prayer, to which Isabel had turned more frequently after the first miscarriage. Now, she read silently, "The Churching of Women, Prayers for Women After Childbirth. Though children and the fruit of the womb are an heritage and gift that cometh of the Lord." The next morning, Isabel stood beside Tom below the lantern room, holding the baby as he tapped out the signal. He had thought carefully about the wording. His fingers were unsteady as he began. He had been dreading sending news of the stillbirth, but this felt much worse. "Baby arrived early. Stop. Took us both by surprise. Stop. Isabel recovering well. Stop. No need for medical help. Stop. Little girl. Stop. Lucy." He turned to Isabel. "Anything else?" "The weight. People always ask the weight." She thought back to Sarah Porter's baby. "Say 7 pounds 1 ounce. Tom looked at her in surprise at the ease with which the lie came to her. He turned back to the key and tapped out the figures. When the reply arrived, he transcribed it and noted it in the signals book. "Congratulations, stop. Marvellous news, stop. Have officially recorded increase in Janus population as per regulations, stop. Ralph and Bluey send cheers, stop. Grandparents will be informed pronto, stop." He sighed, aware of a pressure in his chest, and waited a while before going to report the reply to Isabel. In the weeks that followed, Isabel bloomed. She sang as she went about the cottage. She could not keep from showering Tom with hugs and kisses all through the day. Her smile dazzled him with its sheer uninhibited joy. And the baby? The baby was peaceful and trusting. She did not question the embrace which held her, the hands which caressed her, the lips which kissed her and crooned, "Mama's here, Lucy. Mama's here," as she was rocked to sleep. There was no denying that the child was thriving. Her skin seemed to glow with a soft halo. Isabel's breasts responded to the baby's suckling by producing milk again within weeks. The relactation Dr. Griffiths described in clinical detail. And the child fed without a moment's hesitation, and so the two of them had agreed some sort of contract. But Tom took to staying a fraction longer in the lantern room in the mornings after extinguishing the light. Time and again he would catch himself turning back the page of the log to 27th of April and staring at the blank space. You could kill a bloke with rules, Tom knew that. And yet sometimes they were what stood between man and savagery, between man